News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. That's jackandrea.com. The Morning Show is next.
And we welcome you to the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really excited for the opportunity to speak today with a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. Thomas Knorr, Professor of History, Valor Distinguished Professor in the Humanities. He has been on the morning show at least once before. It's been quite some time. We had a really fun conversation about a book that he wrote called Soapy, which was a biography of a very intriguing figure from the mid-20th century. But what we are going to be talking about today relates quite directly to the COVID-19 crisis in which we currently find ourselves. Professor Knorr, as a professor of history, knows something about some of the moments in our nation's history when we have contended with other public health crises. And of course, each one is, in a sense, its own unique event. And yet, from just about all of them, there are lessons to be learned or lessons we sometimes fail to learn. And Professor Knorr has been doing some research into some of the most significant epidemics that have been part of our own country's history. And that's what we're going to be talking about for the next few minutes. Professor Knorr, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you. Can I start with a story?
Sure.
Way back when dinosaurs roamed the earth and I was a young freshman in college, I decided to major in history. And I went to the department chair's office and we sat down and talked about history. And he said to me, "Well, Mr. Knorr, history has much to cheer about, much to cry about." Mm. And I think the topic today is certainly one not to cheer about, to cry about.
Absolutely.
As many positives, but the thing we're talking today are not going to be particularly positives.
Right. I do want to mention also that that you are about to retire from Carthage after quite a long tenure there. When did you begin teaching at Carthage?
I started in 1973 when Harold Lentz was still president. The chapel had not yet opened, and college was much different than it is now. So it's been 47 years.
Hmm. Was there anything in particular that prompted you to enter the world of history as your professional focus? What was it that sort of tripped that love affair into being?
Well, that's interesting because I was going to be a literature major. I loved French literature, and I was going to study that. But it was the events that were going on when I was in college that caused me to study history. Vietnam War, civil rights movement, urban riots. I decided I really had to figure out what was going on in my country. And the way to do that was not looking at French novels, to look at history. So it was the events of the mid to late 60s that caused me to decide to figure out what's going on. And so I decided to specialize in American history, particularly 20th century America, and American foreign relations, because that were the events that were surrounding me, particularly civil rights, Vietnam, the violence of the 60s. That caused me to study history.
Hmm. Well, as we have already mentioned, our own nation's history has included some significant epidemics that played out sometimes in very dramatic and tragic fashion. And some of these epidemics are well remembered, and others are all but forgotten. And so that's one of the things that we will explore, is why certain such events in our history linger so powerfully, and others are allowed to, in a sense, fall away from our collective memory. Do you have any theories on why certain epidemics remain with us while others are all but forgotten?
Well, I think it's partly the distance. One of the things I'm going to talk about is the impact of disease on Native Americans in early colonial history, and we tend not to think much about that. Obviously, now we think a lot about the Spanish flu epidemic because people are drawing parallels with that today. And more contemporary things like the polio crisis of the 40s and 50s, the AIDS crisis, people still can remember those. But others that are not remembered. Obviously, the one that most people think about is the Black Death, the plague of Europe in the 14th century, when it's estimated that nearly half the population of Europe died. And that's one that many historians and public know a little bit about, not just because of the immensity of it, but the fact that people led to questioning about, is this the end of the earth? Is God punishing us? And if people are interested in European plagues, there's a wonderful book, what a great title, called Rats, Lice, and History, by a guy named Hans Zinsser, written way back in the 30s. I remember reading in graduate school. It talks about plagues in Europe, the plague of Athens, which led Sparta to conquer Athens, the Black Plague. So there's much on European plagues in history. Not so much on America, because we tend not to focus on the negatives. We tend to look for positive things.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what you just touched on. That is the tragic story of how Native Americans were exposed to various diseases from Europeans who came here to colonize. First of all, is it difficult to even know the specifics of something like that? I mean, given the amount of time that has elapsed, and maybe other issues with how much this particular story was chronicled even at the time.
Part of the problem is that the statistics we have are obviously very vague. Didn't have censuses of Native Americans in the 1500s. So much of the numbers are guesstimates, but they are just overwhelming. Native Americans have been cut off from contact with other civilizations for 700-800 years. When the Europeans arrived, they brought with them malaria, scarlet fever, typhoid, and particularly smallpox, which were devastating. Native Americans had not built up immunities to these, and the numbers are overwhelming. For example, Mexico, they estimate that had about 30 million people when Cortez landed. 50 years later, less than 3 million, which means 27 million died. Florida had about 700,000 Native Americans in 1500, less than 2,000 by 1700.
Wow.
So the numbers are just overwhelming. And particularly smallpox, which was the most deadly disease for Native Americans. And there were stories, I'm not so sure they're true, that from the smallpox wards of Europe, they actually sent blankets over to the New World and to the Native Americans. Not so sure that's true, but it shows the madness. But the death rate estimates are about 70% of Native Americans died in the first 200 years of European settlement. Almost all through disease, particularly smallpox, till 1770 when Edward Jenner developed a vaccine. But that was the great killer in early American history, particularly in the Caribbean and in the Midwest. And later on, when the Native Americans were removed to the West, you had another plague of smallpox in the 1820s and 30s of the Plains Indians. And again, the numbers are about 35% died.
Wow, that's just staggering. I mean, one can hardly wrap one's head around those kind of numbers. And to think of such a tragedy of towering proportions, and yet a tragedy that is all but forgotten by most of us.
Yeah, there's a book I use in my survey class that has a chapter about the impact of Europeans on the New World, and they talk about things like the horse and Christianity. And they also talk about disease. Europeans brought with them lots of things. And one of the reasons why Europe was able to conquer the Native Americans so rapidly was through the impact of disease, which has wiped out entire populations. And like European cultures with the Black Plague, it caused many Native Americans to question their spirituality and their religion. The religious leaders of the Native Americans couldn't figure out what was happening. What had they done wrong? They went through all their traditional ceremonies and religious symbols. It didn't work. So it caused not only a physical crisis, it caused a spiritual crisis amongst many Native Americans.
We're speaking with Dr. Thomas Knorr, a professor of history at Carthage College, and talking about some of the epidemics that have been part of American history. Just now talking about the staggering tragedy of Native Americans in horrifying numbers dying from diseases brought here by European colonists. If we proceed further into American history, what would be some of the next epidemics that we would find?
Well, the biggest one in 19th century America was cholera. America became industrialized, cities, massive immigrants coming over here. The result is that when you have thousands of people congregated in cities like New York or Boston or Philadelphia, disease spread much more quickly than rural America. And cholera is due largely to impure drinking water. And with the rise of the cities, you've got incredible sanitation problems, pollution problems. And so you had tremendous epidemics of cholera raging through nearly all American cities. And again, the numbers are hard to know, but it's estimated that nearly 30 million Americans died in the 19th century from cholera epidemics. Chicago lost about 15,000 people in the 1850s. Milwaukee lost nearly 15,000 people in the same time period. And a trivia fact, one of the reasons for the reversal of the Chicago River in 1900 was cholera. Sewage was dumped into the Chicago River, particularly with the slaughterhouses, and it flowed into Lake Michigan, which provided the drinking water for Chicago. And it was one of the results was massive cholera. So they reversed the river in 1900, sent the sewage downstream to St. Louis, and that was partly in response to trying to clean up the drinking water in Chicago. It also led to a federal lawsuit against Chicago for doing that, and they ultimately won. But the problem with cholera, again, was largely drinking water. And also, who to blame? This was the rise of immigration. They often blamed these diseases, particularly cholera, on immigrants. In Chicago, cholera is called the German disease or the Irish disease. The assumption was somehow these, quote, Europeans were bringing with them disease, where it wasn't really that. It was obviously drinking problems. But cholera is a big epidemic that in the 19th century. There were others like scarlet fever and measles. But cholera raced through nearly all American cities in the 1850s up to the 1870s.
Hmm. One of the things I'm struck by is the difference between the first thing you talked about involving Native Americans when North America was first colonized and these epidemics of the 19th century, when I would assume our population was a bit more connected by things like newspapers and other means of communication, by no means as connected as we are now. But I wonder what kind of a difference that would make in terms of one part of the country knowing about what was going on in another part of the country. I mean, in a sense, a higher level of collective awareness about these epidemics as they would first emerge. Do you have any sense of this point in time?
Yeah, you got the development by the 1840s and 50s of mass newspapers and the Telegraph, which brought let these news to be broadcast around. The first cholera epidemic in Philadelphia and New York was before it hit in the Midwest. And you got stories about that, and the idea was, well, this is just something in the East Coast. It's not going to affect us. Later on, obviously, it did. And you got stories, not only true stories, but I don't say fake news, but sensationalized stories about the amount of deaths and the amount of suffering. And partly it was due to mass newspapers and to the Telegraph, which allowed these to be communicated to it. It wasn't until the 20th century that you got things like radio and television, which allowed instantaneous examination of disease throughout the world.
And I wonder, as you, I assume, have explored news accounts and so on, that I suspect that there was sometimes a predilection for exaggeration or sensationalism or in some ways fanning the flames of public fear, something that we hear a lot about right now in our current media culture. I suspect that that was part of the story of these epidemics, for instance, in the 19th century.
Yeah, particularly because the knowledge of disease was so primitive. People didn't know exactly what was causing these diseases. They realized eventually it was largely due to drinking water, particularly with cholera. But people didn't know, so there are all sorts of rumors that the disease are being spread by, again, foreigners coming into America, bringing the disease, caused by certain whatever ethnic group you wanted to blame for this. Again, the numbers are not as overwhelming as the Native Americans or the Black Death, but they were significant enough that people are looking to find out not only what was going on, but who blamed for this. And you've got partly, again, another great religious revival trying to see this as somehow God's wrath upon people for not following the commandments. You've got sensational stories about there were bands of immigrants moving from city to city, spreading the disease. All of those were not true, but they show the fact that people not only looking at what happened, but trying to figure out why. Why are so many people dying from diseases? And cholera was very quickly, you died within a few days after getting it. That led to, again, looking for some sort of explanation.
Hmm. Just over 100 years ago was, of course, what in many respects was one of the most terrible pandemics of them all, the great influenza pandemic of Spanish flu. Tell our listeners, first of all, something about the emergence of this and ultimately the scope of this terrible pandemic.
Yeah, it's the one that's much the news today because of the vastness of it and the fact that it was global. Even though it was called Spanish flu, it spread throughout the world. 1918, the end of World War One, you began to get the emergence of it, and it lasted probably till 1920 at the peak. It's estimated that over 500 million people were infected. That's one-fourth of the world's population. And 20 to 50 million people died. That's five times the number that died in the war. So it was immense. And the strange thing about this, the tragic, was it hit younger people harder. Unlike the virus today, which is, you know, most devastating to people older with disease, this hit young people, particularly in their 20s and 30s, more than it did older people due to the effect. And the fact that back then we didn't have the, quote, social distancing we have now. After World War One, they held victory parades in New York and Chicago and Boston, hundreds of thousands of people to welcome the troops home. And that was one of the reasons that spread so quickly. You had thousands and thousands of people out who were infected with the disease, either from World War One vets or from others. It finally declined in 1919, 1920. But it's ironic that the press and the government tried to restrict coverage of the Spanish flu. They underestimated it. They said this is going to pass. It's not a big thing. It wasn't until 1919 that the government finally acknowledged, the U.S. government, that this was an immense tragedy and a global tragedy. And they began to put things in like limiting the amount of meetings, limiting crowds, much like we're doing today. Not nearly as dominant as we're doing today with social distancing, but that was quite late at the epidemic. And the size of it and the scope are global, and the number of people affected causes many to try to find similarities between what happened 100 years ago and what's happening today.
In a recent rebroadcast of an American Experience documentary, one of the points that is made is that then-President Woodrow Wilson, through the course of his presidency, never made a single public pronouncement that acknowledged the flu epidemic in any way. And, of course, the very end of his presidency, he is significantly hobbled by a serious stroke. But nevertheless, there was a period of time where he was in a position to make such a statement and, for whatever reason, chose to remain silent. It's kind of astonishing to imagine such a thing.
Yeah, that's what I said, that the government not officially denied it but didn't recognize it until 1919, which was the last year of Wilson's presidency. And Wilson was preoccupied with League of Nations and the end of World War One, and either was distracted or did not really, was not aware or kept silent about it. But he wasn't the only one. Public health officials in many cities discounted the disease until the numbers were so overwhelming that by 1919 they began to acknowledge that this is a global issue. But the initial response of most government officials, not just Wilson, was simply to ignore it or at least not mention it publicly, unlike the epidemics later, like polio and AIDS and the crisis today. Government was pretty silent about this, not only in the U.S., but also many European governments really didn't face up to this until a year and a half into its crisis.
Hmm. And remind us again of the ultimate scope of this influenza pandemic. You made reference to it really being a global pandemic. Is this something that ultimately touched every continent on Earth? And what kind of numbers are we talking about in terms of those who ultimately perished?
Yeah, it was global, and the estimates are that 20 to 50 million died. Again, our numbers are shaky because we don't have the detailed census numbers that we have today. And eventually, one-fourth of the population in the world contracted the disease. Doesn't mean they all died, but the numbers are just overwhelming. 500 million people were struck with this disease, and estimated said 20 to 50 million died. So the numbers are gigantic. And again, we don't have the detailed numbers that we have today, where every day you can get on a newscast how many people infected, how many people died, because the census records are vague, particularly for Asian and African countries. But it was huge, and that's one reason why many people invoke it today to talk about the global and the vastness of the infection today.
We're speaking with Dr. Thomas Knorr, a professor of history at Carthage College, and we are talking about some of the past epidemics that have been part of our country's history. And a little closer to our day would be also an epidemic that was truly terrifying, and that was the polio epidemic of the late 1940s and early 1950s. Tell us more about this outbreak of polio and just how terrifying it was for so much of the American public.
Yeah, there's been a lot written about polio, not only the disease, but the kind of paranoia, hysteria that followed it. The first major epidemic of polio was in 1916 in New York, when about 6,000 people died. And the tragedy was that polio hit younger people, children, more than it hit adults. It affected adults also, but it was children. And even as early as 1916, New York closed all of its beaches, parks, amusement parks, to try to prevent the spread of disease. But it reoccurred again, as you said, in the 40s and 50s. Its estimate peaked in 1952 when about 3,500 people died and about 26,000 people were paralyzed. I don't know if your readers or your listeners remember iron lungs, these horrible machines that polio victims were put into to keep them breathing. And it also led to people being physically unable to walk, even to recover from the disease. And the result was panic in many American cities in the 40s and 50s, particularly in the summer, because that's when the disease spread, closing swimming pools, closing outdoor playgrounds, people keeping their children in the house to try to prevent the disease. And it led to, again, hysteria in the 50s, a fear, particularly among parents, that their children would contract this disease. Finally, in 1954, Jonas Salk invented the polio vaccine. Your listeners might remember the little sugar cubes that we were given when I was a kid to take, which, in a sense, didn't just wipe out polio, but knocked it down to a very tiny percentage. But polio was in hysteria, particularly in the late 40s and 50s, and particularly because it affected children and the fact that it tended to be largely in urban areas, just like the other diseases.
Hmm. And my understanding is that polio would often move into a family and mow down one child after another, or certainly there are plenty of stories of that where every child in a given family would ultimately contract polio, and it's just hard to imagine anything more heartbreaking or frightening than that.
Yeah, it was, and again, this is the time of the post-war baby boom, suburbia, families are growing, more and more children, people are now, in a sense, the Great Depression is over, World War II is over, people were optimistic, and then lurking in the background was this terrible disease which threatened your children. So it led to, as I said, not only fear, but almost a paranoid idea about it. And the fact that by keeping your children from going swimming or playing with their friends or going to the park would prevent them from the disease. And it did to a certain extent. But as you said, if someone got affected in your family, often others would get affected too. And again, adults got affected also. But it was children that were the most poignant. And that the strongest image of polio was children dying or being paralyzed or being attached to these terrible iron lung machines to keep them breathing. It was a horrific disease.
Right. It's also a case in which, and I would suspect this is unlike any of the other epidemics that we have mentioned before this, earlier epidemics, this would be perhaps the first epidemic in which the general public is galvanized to action with the famous March of Dimes. I'm assuming, anyway, that is the first time that the public is called upon for this kind of organized response to a public health crisis.
Yeah, I think you're right. I thought there were efforts like during the Spanish flu for charities and churches to mobilize to either provide money or to provide care for these people. But I think polio led, you're right, to a national group, which is still around today, the March of Dimes and other groups like the Red Cross and Salvation Army, to try to do something about the disease. So that's a good point. You could be an historian.
He's right. It's just from talking to great historians like you. Closer to our own day, of course, have been other outbreaks of things like SARS and Legionnaires' disease. I would think of more recent epidemics, the one that is maybe numerically and sociologically the most significant would be the AIDS epidemic. I know this is something else that you have explored to some extent. What did you uncover about the AIDS epidemic that you think would be interesting for us to know?
Well, a number of things. One is that when the first major cases of AIDS were in the early 1980s, and it was totally unclear what caused this. It was called the Haitian disease for a while. I don't know if your people remember that, because the first cases were in Haiti. But it quickly spread to particularly to the gay and Hispanic community, And eventually about 600,000 died before the AIDS cocktail, this concoction of drugs, controlled it. And again, it was a very slow reaction to this, partly because it was considered, quote, a gay disease, that only gay people would get it. And there were some who argued this is a punishment upon gay people for this. And it wasn't really until Ronald Reagan, who was the president at the time, kind of ignored the disease, until Rock Hudson, one of his friends from the movie industry, contracted AIDS and died. And then you began to get more of a government reaction to this, the safe sex campaign, the idea of isolating using condoms, the idea of trying to cut down drug use, which AIDS was passed partly through that. And so the response was relatively slow, particularly because it was considered to be limited only to drug users and gay people and Haitians, until they found it spread to many others as well. They barred visitors from Haiti for long years. It wasn't until 2006 that George Bush, the president, allowed people that are HIV positive to enter the country again. So, again, a devastating effect not just upon gay people, but upon Americans generally. And it's the crisis that seems to have been reasonably resolved now with the new drug the prescriptions and the, quote, AIDS cocktail, which seems to be fairly effective in at least controlling the disease. But it's one that's much in the news prior to this one, because the numbers are large, but nothing like what we're seeing today, or nothing like we saw with the Spanish flu or Native Americans. But it's probably the most recent mass campaign. I don't know as much about the SARS and the other epidemics than AIDS.
As you have been looking back over these unfortunate chapters in our country's history, I wonder if you are coming away with any lessons that you wish we would all learn, whether we as ordinary citizens and how we meet these kind of challenges, or maybe we as in our leaders learning lessons from some of these past incidents. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, one thing I think that's common to many of these is trying to find someone or something to blame. We need to find an explanation for these things. Obviously, the science tells us what causes these. But throughout history, they've looked for other thing, people, groups, ideas to blame. In the Great Plague, they blame God's wrath upon us. Native Americans blamed that the Europeans were evil agents. Cholera, they blamed the immigrants. The Spanish flu, they blamed this was due to World War I veterans. We try to find some easy explanation, not just the science of what spreads these diseases, but to blame someone or something for it. Said during the AIDS epidemic, some people blame this as God's wrath upon gay people for violating traditional sexuality. The other thing is that government response to this has been very sporadic. Obviously, as you mentioned, during the Spanish flu, the government tended not to react very strongly to this. During the early AIDS crisis, there was very little government action until the mid-80s to deal with this. So I don't know. There are, quote, lessons from history, but I'm not so sure that there are any easy ones from this one. Obviously, today we realize that government, private health organizations has an obligation to try to do something about this. But that's relatively new. Often people could understand what causes these diseases, could understand how to control them, so they look for an easy explanation. Oh, it's those immigrants that cause this disease. Oh, it's those, whatever group you want to criticize. There's been debate, you know, about calling this the, quote, Chinese epidemic, that we're stereotyping the Chinese. I'm not so sure that's always true. But we need to find not only what's happening, we need to find out why. And often the irrational is easier than the scientific explanation for why we have these horrible events.
Well, on that note, we finish out what's been an illuminating conversation. Dr. Thomas Knorr, Valor Distinguished Professor of the Humanities, Professor of History at Carthage College, I really appreciate the time that you have taken not only for this conversation but to explore some of these important moments from our own history. I really appreciate you taking the time to be part of the morning show. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. I wish I had a more cheery topic.
Right. I was just going to say pleasure is not quite the right word, but it's certainly good to be given this kind of interesting information. And I thank you once again for being part of the morning show.
Thank you. Stay healthy.
The time is 8:46, and you are listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll be getting to part two of today's program in just a moment. A quick reminder that the Morning Show is also available to you as a podcast via Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, all of the major podcast platform providers. This past weekend were two very interesting Morning Show podcasts. Saturday, a look at Robert Sullivan's fascinating book called Rats, looking at the amazing creature, the rat. On Sunday, an interview with a very, very fine operatic singer by the name of Nathan Gunn. And the previous Monday, the podcast format of the program on a day when we had no broadcast was Out of the Archives, a memorable conversation back in 1999 with entertainment legend Steve Allen. Again, seek out the podcast version of The Morning Show if you would like to hear some of these special treats that are not broadcast Monday through Friday. Part two of today's program is coming up in just a moment. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to talk about joy. And we're going to be talking about joy with Joy Cho, who has a business actually called Oh Joy, in which she shares all kinds of products that and resources that are meant to generate greater joy, even in the midst of what we are all experiencing right now with COVID-19. And she's also the author of a series of wonderful books for very young readers, including You're Okay, Be Curious, and Oh So Kind, which we're going to be talking about. Joy Cho, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if we could just take a moment to talk about something that you wrote about in your blog that I think is so timely. You actually have offered up a lot of thoughts in your blog about things to do around the house during this time of sequestering. And you also had a very thoughtful blog on what people can do to support small businesses. And I so appreciated what you had to say there. I wonder if you would mind taking just a minute or two to share some of the thoughts you have on how people who are concerned about small businesses that maybe mean a lot to them, how they can support them right now.
Of course. I mean, as a small business owner of 15 years, I feel the effects of what's happening right now. I have so many friends who have small businesses, from retail shops to restaurants to other types of ventures. And everybody's feeling it. And so the thing is that we want to feel like, yes, this is a tough time. We know it's a tough time. It's a little bit unknown, but we also want to come through on the other side of this and still have our businesses intact and be able to still do the things that we set out to do to provide our various services for people. And so I talked about ways to support, you know, some simple things, which could be supporting people with food deliveries. If any of your local restaurants are doing food deliveries right now, obviously you can't go to the restaurant, but if they're offering some other form of alternative, gift cards, different places for a future gift, any income helps small businesses right now. Buying their products, you know, I know that people aren't able to spend a ton of money right now, but if you need to buy something and a small business carries it, buy it from that small business because you're providing, you're helping to pay their employees, you're helping to pay their rent. And then there are also some suggestions. You know what? If you just can't spend a dime, which we totally get because some people have lost their jobs, I can't tell somebody who's lost their job to go and buy a product. There's also ways you can support via social media. You can go onto their Instagram and you can comment. You can just say, hey, we miss you. I miss, you know, coming to your restaurant, or I miss coming to your shop. Can't wait to see your back. Or even just sending them, honestly, a DM or an email or a note just to say, hey, I'm sure it's a tough time for you. When you are back and up and running, I will be there. Or I love, you know, you've been there for our family all these years. We've loved coming to visit you. Whatever that might be, there are so many ways that you can do that, and it means so much to all these small businesses that are hurting right now.
Very nicely put, and I would direct people to seek out your blog because you offer a whole lot of nice thoughts and suggestions, and some of them are very, very timely for what we're experiencing right now. Remind our listeners how they find your blog.
You can find everything at ojoy.com, and from there you can link out to our blog, to our books, to our social media, and anything else OJoy related.
So when did this notion of creating joyous products, joyful products, first occur to you, and why or how?
I mean, when I started my business, I was mostly designing for other brands, and I was using my talent and my design skills to design things for other companies. And as OJoy, the blog, grew, and as my social media presence grew, I was able to switch to focusing on just things under the OJoy name. And so my style has just sort of naturally evolved to be very colorful, to be very happy. My name is Joy, so it's sort of been part of me my whole life. And so I think that those things, both aesthetically and conceptually, started coming together, and it just sort of made sense. For me, I think that it's a joy to be able to love what you do and to be able to love your work. And if you can provide inspiration for people to make their day better in some small way, to me, that's really the most fulfilling thing.
I wonder how your attitude about joy and what creates joy and nurtures it in yourself and in others, how your understanding of that has maybe changed, evolved during this COVID-19 crisis. How do you find yourself thinking about and generating joy right now, given this current situation in which we find ourselves?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's not easy. I'll be honest with you. Being somebody who is known for joy and who I think is often expected to be joyful, I find myself daily in not so happy moments. I mean, it's not easy for any of us, and I think that we're all going through a range of emotions. Part of it is me acknowledging the fact that it's okay, because we can't all be happy all the time. Things are not perfect all the time, and they certainly are not perfect right now. Acknowledging that, going through the motions, letting us process. There's a lot of emotions we're all going through. And then what I really try to do, and my husband is also very helpful with this for me, he is always reminding me, like, let's be grateful for what we have. Let's be grateful for our health, that our kids are healthy, that they're safe with us at home, that we're able to, you know, be flexible, work from home, and teach them, even though it's crazy and it's very hectic trying to do all of those things, let's be grateful for what we have. And that sort of helps to bring me back. And so I do have to daily check in with myself, and it's a conscious thing that we have to do to be able to try to do it. But when I have children at home who are looking to us to see how they should be and how they should react, I remind myself that I want to see them see parents with a positive attitude right now. And we can obviously talk about the stresses of the world when they're asleep or when they're in another room, and show them sort of our best selves as much as we can.
Hmm. I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about these lovely books that you have created especially with very, very young readers in mind. I mean, in some cases, these might be some of the very first books that a youngster might have. Tell our listeners about these books and what it was like for you to create them.
Absolutely. So there's a series of three books that we published with Scholastic. The first one is called Be Curious, and that one has just released a couple weeks ago. The books are all about qualities that I think are so important to instill in young children, from curiosity to compassion to kindness. And these are for early readers for ages 0 to 3, for kids who are not quite reading yet, but then actual early readers who are starting to read from 4, 5, 6 and up. It's also great for them to read as well to their siblings or with their parents. And it's never too early to instill these great qualities. And so to be able to talk about them in a way that kids can understand, in a way that they can digest and bring those thoughts into their lives in an early age, to bring them into early childhood and into adulthood, I think is something that was so important to me, especially as I have children of my own, and I see the qualities that I would like them to be able to know are important and to bring into their future.
Mm. Explain physically what these books look like and the way you have constructed them to make them a rich experience for a youngster besides just the colorful pictures and so on.
So these board books are roughly 7x7, and they have really thick pages. They're nice and hardy for those small fingers who aren't quite gentle with turning pages yet. And so there's also flaps and cutouts. And so as you go through this first story, Be Curious, with this cat, you are getting to follow his journey, but you're also getting to interact. And especially when a child can't read yet, they can still be tactile. They can still interact with the flaps and the peekaboo cutouts and things that can make them feel like they're a part of the story with their parents.
And I read someplace that you actually see even older children perhaps enjoying these books and or returning to these books later on.
Yeah, my kids are 5 and 8, and even though they're not at that very early 0 to 3 age, they love reading them. I mean, they can both read them on their own and to themselves and to each other, but it's fun for them as well. So they're definitely books that can take a whole family through a variety of ages and continue to get passed on from sibling to sibling or to other family members as well.
The website again for all that you offer is ojoy.com. That's O-H-J-O-Y, ojoy.com. Joy Cho, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and best wishes to you and your family.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be talking about the special challenges that are being faced by people with addictions, people on the road to recovery during the COVID-19 crisis. What are some of the special stresses, the special triggers that can make life very difficult for somebody in recovery? In part one of tomorrow's Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Gwida Brown from the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drugs. In part two, I'll be speaking with Michael Mahoney, who is director of Chicago Services for the Betty Ford Hazelton Foundation. On Wednesday's Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Jonathan Shaler, a professor of communications at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, talking not only about what it's like for him to do his teaching online, but also finding out from him about a wonderful project which he helped to create. It was an online performance of a Shakespeare play called Coriolanus, and this involved a number of his colleagues in the Shakespeare in Prisons network, friends and colleagues from across the country who united for an evening performance. And it went so well that they did a second one this past weekend and plan on continuing with their efforts over the next few weeks. We'll find out all about it on Wednesday. On Thursday, Brian Albrecht joins us, the president of Gateway Technical College, updating us on Gateway's response to the COVID-19 crisis. And on Friday, some new authors talking about some wonderful new books, including Tom Clavin, the author of a book called Tombstone, which tells the story of the gunfight at the OK Corral and its aftermath. Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection of Kenosha t-shirts.